This podcast examines issues on violence driven by gender inequality, a profound and widespread global health problem that is likely to have personally touched the lives of our listeners. Listen with care and compassion, and please talk to someone should anything come up for you while listening to this episode. For more resources, email svri@svri.org.
Every single one of us are part of this landscape. We can all be accountable to considering who is being excluded and who isn't at the table, who needs to be, and how to get them there.
You're listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast from the SVRI. I'm Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I am Angelica Bina. Our vision is to see a world free of violence against women and violence against children. And in this podcast, we learn how to make that vision a reality.
In today's episode, we're exploring the importance of ethical funding and the vital role it plays in making sure money goes to the most effective research projects in low and middle income countries.
We need more partnerships. We need to avoid the competition for the resources and rather create collective platforms that showcase the work that's being done, that showcase the work that needs to be done, and that showcase organizations and individuals that might not otherwise have access to funding.
That is the SVRI's Aisha Mago, who is leading the development of our ethical funding guide. We are also going to hear from Annika Lysen, Senior Program Manager at the Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, SIDA.
Sweden, we are one of the few countries which have a feministic foreign policy, which is built on 3 R: rights, representation, and resources. And as part of this foreign policy, we have a strategy for global gender equality and women's and girls' rights. That gives us, SIDA, a clear mandate to support women's rights organizations, both movement building and networks and feministic work on national and local level. And we work quite a lot through feministic funds, like the Global Fund for Women and FRIDA, and the Young Feminist Funds. And we also have contributions focusing specifically on violence against women, like Support to Girls Not Brides and the UN Trust Fund to End Violence Against Women and the SVRI.
And we also have Catherine Marie Ballin on the podcast, whose PhD work looks into aid effectiveness, gender equality, and decolonizing aid. She's also the founder and managing director of KCMB Consulting and the Connective Paths Foundation.
The Connective Paths Foundation aims to highlight the importance of feminist organizing in order to accelerate meeting the goals of gender equality and women's empowerment, especially in supporting women's rights organizations in low and middle income countries.
So, what is ethical funding? It is funding that is equitable, rooted in a deep understanding of the local context, whilst giving everyone the opportunity to have their voice heard, particularly those most affected by the issues being addressed.
You may detect parallels between ethical funding and the subject of our last episode, the Global Shared Research Agenda. As Aisha notes, the two strategies align closely with one another.
A key recommendation arising from the Global Shared Research Agenda process was really that it should be used as a tool to advocate for increased and enhanced research funding that addresses critical research gaps in the field. So the GSRA focuses on, you know, what should really be funded. And this ethical guidance looks at how to fund better. So there's the what and then there's the how. And by funding better, what we mean is funding that's grounded in feminist principles, that acknowledges and addresses power dynamics, that involves honest, transformative relationships between donors and grantees, and ultimately creates accessible and equitable processes to support priority-driven research in lower and middle-income countries. Together, these two pieces of work identify key directions and ways to fund the research. In addition, they also connect in terms of underlying principles. So, for instance, stakeholders from the consultative processes that we ran for the guidance emphasized the importance of funding knowledge gaps and of ensuring diversity and inclusion. There's lots of overlaps between the two, but I think they work really brilliantly together in terms of the what and the how to fund better research.
As Aisha mentioned, based on our own research and principles, we believe it is important that ethical funding is grounded in feminist principles for a multitude of reasons. Catherine explains.
So a decolonial and feminist approach to funding projects and research are needed. It means providing a space for the voices and the lived experiences of marginalized, non-Western women to speak of their identities, who they are, and how they manage their personal and organizational lives, and what issues are most important to them. This is important because having this approach, first, it recognizes, it makes visible, and it addresses the legacies that colonialism, racism, and patriarchy continue to have. Then it envisions a world and an international development and research sector that is capable of moving beyond these repressive structures. So looking at an example of how improvement can be made across the five components for having an equitable partnership or equitable funder-fundee relationship in preventing sexual violence, we could see, for example, first, roles and responsibilities involve examining the roles of international NGOs or northern-based NGOs and researchers vis-a-vis NGOs in the low and middle-income countries, and ensuring these are balanced and that they center, these relationships center indigenous, feminist, and local expertise and knowledge. Regarding participation in decision-making, this is not just in the implementation stage of a project, which is common practice at the moment, but the need to ensure participation of the NGOs and LMICs in the project design stage, and even in identifying, you know, the community issues that are a priority to design a project around in the first place. Third, when you're looking at access and control to resources, yes, we are looking at increasing the funding for gender equality and for women's rights organizations in the Global South, but we're also looking at how they can determine budget priorities that include core funding for their organizations so they can continue to work on their missions, have sustained impact and results even after a project funding cycle. Fourth, this approach also helps in ensuring safety and preventing exploitation and abuse. And exploitation and abuse covers a wide range of issues, from sexual harassment in the workplace to sexual exploitation in the aid sector more widely, as well as co-opting and invisibilizing indigenous knowledge and expertise as a form of exploitation. Lastly, a decolonial and feminist approach helps in addressing both the practical needs of local NGOs, you know, the basic organizational needs for operational effectiveness and to sustain their operations, as well as their strategic interests or the issues regarding how they can transform existing inequities faced by these local NGOs in the current funding landscape.
Right now, very little funding is dedicated to understanding what works to prevent violence against women and how to strengthen responses for survivors. And the research that does happen is often fragmented. In fact, there are a raft of issues with the current funding model that this guidance aims to address.
During the processes that we ran, the consultative processes, there were many key issues that came up around the current funding model and key challenges being faced by researchers and practitioners and even by funders. And one of these was that, you know, funding timelines are too short and restrictive. There were issues around research agendas being set by donors rather than the priorities coming from the field, as we've just mentioned. Inaccessible processes in terms of accessibility for different kinds of researchers in different places, and also issues with the model in terms of funding that doesn't address inequitable relationships or power differentials on the ground. What we're hoping is that this guidance will help actually in several ways. One, based on sort of widespread inputs from the field, we've highlighted core principles related to what better funding actually means. The guidance also reframes funders as collaborative and equitable partners. And the way it's structured is that it acts as a practical guide. It's not just theoretical. We've identified 7 stages of funding for the research process, and we've suggested specific steps that can be taken to convert the identified principles into practice. I mean, the vast majority of these wouldn't actually be very hard to do in terms of reorganizing or wouldn't necessarily require vastly more resources. So in that sense, we hope it'll be a really useful practical guide. I think the guidance also helps by identifying and advocating for the uptake and use of a lot of really excellent resources that we found in our initial scoping review of the field. These are resources that already exist that can assist with thinking about different approaches for funding. So in that sense, the guidance can act as a standalone document that hopefully will be very helpful for the field with the principles and the steps, but it can also be a springboard for more in-depth exploration for donors or researchers or practitioners who want to go further, and it's a sort of easy collation of the resources.
Aisha explained how the guidance reframes funders as collaborative and equitable partners. But how do funders hold themselves accountable when it comes to funding projects in an ethical and equitable way? Anika explains SIDA's strategy.
First of all, we as funders, we need to reflect on ourselves. Are we conducting our work in an ethical way? And how do we ensure that there is a true partnership and that we as funders are not steering the wheel, but we make sure that it's a partnership where our partners are in the front seat. At the same time, we must ensure that the partners that we are working with, that they are accountable when it comes to ethical line. And we do have a specific ethical guideline for partners when we are entering a partnership. We ask them to comply to a specific guideline when it comes to ethical guidelines. And that is about corruption, crime, discrimination against all people depending on gender, age, disability, race. So we're trying to put it in a holistic way. And of course, if we ask partners to do that, we must also do that ourselves. So it's very important that we walk the talk.
This guide is vitally important, and I love the way that it has been developed through a participatory process. Let's hear more from our guests now. Out of the guide, four key principles for ethical funding have been identified, which Aisha can tell us about.
I would love to talk about them, in fact. I love talking about these principles.
Me too.
So the first one was decolonizing knowledge and methods of learning. And this principle really applies to rethinking the questions of what constitutes evidence and expertise. How is knowledge created? Whose voices are being heard and whose data counts? And it also involves highlighting the role of practice-based knowledge and encouraging funders to consider mixed methods forms of research. You know, we base this also on a strong feminist approach, which is SVRI's approach to the work that we do. And this approach rejects the notion that there is only one methodology that can gather scientifically sound information. So it also highlights the utility of using creative and participatory research methodologies that ensure that women and children's voices are not marginalized in the research process. And something that came out of this principle that was particularly important was, you know, that for research with marginalized communities, such as women living with HIV or women and children with disabilities, where peer research may be the best way to ensure that the agendas are responsive to the priorities that are being identified through the lived experience, we really need to consider these different types of methodologies. So because there are institutional blockages in terms of who can be considered a researcher or who has the correct qualifications, for instance. So in terms, again, of practical understanding, it's really important that donors recognize, understand, and sort of encourage the use of these different methodologies where relevant and do the planning that is necessary in terms of building capacity of local stakeholders or allowing for additional time to conduct the research in a specific way. The second principle that came out was equity, and we heard about this from multiple perspectives. So it included localization, it included diversity and inclusion, and it also included consideration of issues such as research translation, authorship, and dissemination. And again, to make this a little more practical, action points here would be related to supporting work that's incubated and led by lower and middle-income country researchers, involving local researchers and implementing partners from the very beginning of a research process as co-producers of knowledge. Also things like ensuring that agreements related to authorship, presenting of work, and publication of work are made early on in the process and are fair and inclusive. A third principle is related to longer-term, flexible, and where possible, unrestricted funding. So for researchers and implementing partners in lower and middle-income countries, flexibility within funding and within programmatic arrangement is really critical. And this is to allow partners to adapt their project, adapt their services and activities to changing contexts, and obviously to extenuating circumstances that could arise during a research process. Longer-term research funding, why is that so important? Well, it supports continuous learning. It enables researchers and practitioners to measure impact over time and allows, you know, real innovation to take place during a research process, because then the people who are conducting the research have the space and freedom to experiment or to document, or when something goes wrong, to innovate, to shift, to learn from failures. Finally, our fourth principle was around transforming the funder and grantee relationship. And here we really looked at trust-based philanthropy and what that means. More and more people are talking about this now. And really what we refer to and what SVRI means by that was an affirmative approach that emphasizes that both parties do really have the same objective of wanting the project to succeed and of looking at this as a partnership. So in one sense, it involves rethinking what it means to be the one who's giving the money. What does this involve? You know, offering support beyond money, including mentorship, promoting grantees' work, support, helping grantees expand their access to other funders, even something like transparent and responsive communication in terms of decision-making processes, in terms of deadlines, and in terms of just communicating in a specific way when programs arise. Even those sorts of aspects can go a very long way towards transforming a relationship.
I think the feminist approach as a principle is so important and it ties so well with the SVRI big goal of decolonizing knowledge. Decolonizing knowledge is vital, but without money, we cannot fund this ethical research. So how do you think can we make sure resources are directed to the right places?
So one idea is, you know, we know that working in silos results in duplication of efforts. So can funders, in fact, pool resources, pool thinking and planning? For instance, technical resources for grantees, such as templates for proposals and ethical review processes. Is there an efficient way to work around that? Could funders collaborate on things like developing a funding pipeline, wherein there's a pathway in place for different phases of the research process, including research uptake once a project is over? You know, could this lend a more coherent approach where funders who want to fund different stages can work together and therefore bring more resources in? Another aspect of this could be having joint agreements on funding priorities. Can funders come together to discuss research needs and make sure that these are prioritized when planning funding allocations? Also, another idea would be perhaps, you know, can funders pool resources with other funders in terms of financial resources now, not technical ones, and therefore expand the number of donors working in a specific area and reduce duplication of work? And another resource we came across during this process was we looked at some of the work being done by gender restrictive actors, what we call learning from the opposition. And we looked at how they fund in a specific way that perhaps our field can learn from. So they fund flexibly, they fund with block grants, with gifts, with endowments. The organizations in the movement develop long-term strategies. And I think the violence against women and violence against children fields really need to fund similarly. They need to look at long-term unrestricted funding that's focused on building strength, building institutional resilience, you know, across issues, across national and intersectional alliances, so that key groups in the development and humanitarian sectors are actually working together, incorporating gender equality into different departments.
Next, let's hear from Catherine again, who can tell us more about her research into this subject.
The study explored how women's rights organizations in the Global South can be engaged in a more equitable and empowering manner by donor institutions, the UN, international NGOs, and academic researchers from the Global North in order to improve aid effectiveness and, more critically, to move towards the decolonization of the aid sector. Also, the study investigated why it is critical to improve this engagement with women's rights organizations in lower middle income countries. And what I found is that amidst the backdrop of more open racial discussions prompted by the Black Lives Matter movement, and with the COVID-19 pandemic deepening gender and other forms of inequalities, more and more development actors, both from NGOs, grassroots organizations receiving aid, and among practitioners and researchers working in institutions providing aid, more people are recognizing the negative impact of structural patriarchy and racism in the aid sector, and that these are rooted in power imbalances that mirror historical colonial structures and relations. The findings of the study that analyzed and synthesized, you know, the recommendations of the actors from NGOs, international NGOs, donor agencies, feminist activists, and researchers, it showed that the elements of an equitable partnership demanded by civil society in the Global South from their northern donors and international NGOs, these elements are parallel or the same as the elements of the global development community's efforts for gender equality and justice, as well as their efforts to leave no one behind. The study identified five categories of actions recommended by the respondents in order to make donor-recipient relations more equitable and impactful in the long term. And these are, first, roles and responsibilities; two, looking at participation in decision-making; three, the access to and control of resources; fourth, safety and prevention of exploitation and abuse; and lastly, addressing both practical needs and strategic interests. These are the same five approaches currently already being used to mainstream gender and facilitate inclusion. And this is significant because this means donors, UN, and international NGOs already have the strategies and tools that could now be used to assess and improve the way they partner with civil society organizations in low and middle income countries. Since in theory, these are the same tools they're already using to evaluate gender equality, women's empowerment, and even the SDGs, leaving no one behind principle.
What does good, feminist-driven ethical funding look like, according to you?
I believe feminist funding, ultimately ethical funding, can and should be seen in the funders' goals, principles, and their strategies. So in their goals, it should ideally aim to dismantle the racist, sexist, colonial structures and practices between organizations in donor and recipient countries. It also aims to fund projects and research that disrupt, you know, these prevailing notions of the established political and economic order or social organization. Ultimately, the goal of this type of funding is to shift the power in the philanthropic or development landscapes to the communities and to the people, the women closest to the issues we're addressing. Ethical funding recognizes that colonialism and patriarchy are the root causes of these power over practices and relationships and gender inequality. And it acknowledges the inherent power imbalance present in funder-fundee relationships, but it continues to improve their participatory decision-making processes so that women and communities that are most affected by the work lead the development. Ethical funding, at its core, tries to achieve the feminist development goals by enhancing the power and ambition of all women and girls, and it recognizes and builds on their strengths. It also supports intersectional movements, so including trans and non-binary people, and it addresses multiple forms of discrimination and exclusion. Lastly, ethical funding should be a way to examine new partnerships, new funding modalities that can be designed to address the needs and interests of the Global South feminist movements to achieve their goals and their missions.
And here's Annika again. Her organization, CEDA, has bilateral development cooperation with around 35 countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and Europe. So what does that mean?
We divide our cooperation between global development cooperation and bilateral cooperation. The global cooperation goes to organizations which have a global outreach, and their SVRI is one of the examples, while bilateral organizations are working in a specific country and has a specific country strategy. And I think for CEDA, when it comes to supporting women's rights organizations, it's very good that we can both work globally as well as bilaterally. And funding to women's rights organizations is severely underfunded. And CEDA would like to take responsibility to improve the share of funds that goes to women's rights organizations.
And Annika, are you seeing a shift in global aid towards more long-term funding that is flexible and adaptive? Why is this important, do you think?
I would say there is a lot of discussions about the need for more long-term funding, which is very good that it has come up on the agenda, and that we need funding that is more flexible and adaptive. And that is because the need to support, in not the least on local level, new kinds of organizations that are not the established kinds, but maybe more movement-like. And of course, if we want to fund them, we must also be flexible. But it is a challenge since we also, like we are a government agency, so we have our demands when it comes to internal control, etc. So it is a balance to make sure that we apply to our rules and regulations, and at the same time that we are flexible. And I think when it comes to the Generation Equality Forum, the Global Alliance there can make a difference and highlight these issues. And I think also the years we have had now, unfortunately, it's already 2 years with the pandemic, it has raised the issue that we as funders, we need to be flexible and really listen to what is happening for the organization, what is the context, and that when organizations are flexible towards the situation, as you have been during the pandemic, we as funders, we must also be flexible.
We asked each of our guests for their key insight for creating a more ethical and equitable landscape for violence against women and violence against children research.
It's important to highlight that safeguarding against abuse, exploitation, and discrimination as part of ethical funding is not just about ensuring the inclusion of marginalized individuals or preventing discrimination based on gender, sex, race, ethnicity, or other identity characteristics, but it instead really involves examining how we partner with the organizations that are from lower and middle income countries. There's a lot of policy that has been developed and frameworks on safeguarding individuals, but none that provides a framework for engaging organizations, thus creating a more ethical and equitable landscape for violence against women and violence against children means that funders, the UN, international NGOs, and even national NGOs and researchers treat women's organizations and grassroots organizations more equitably throughout the grant making and project process.
I have actually thought a lot about this question. And I think for me, a key thing is recognizing that every single one of us are part of this landscape. So whether we are funders or activists or practitioners, researchers, no one group can carry the work on without the other. You know, we're all part of it and we all have to work together. So I think a key thing for me is really rethinking money and what it means to give money and also what it means to receive money and how we behave in those relationships and how we can address power differentials at every single stage of that process, you know, where these things come up. I think we can all be accountable to considering how we perpetuate some of the inequalities and some of the power dynamics that play out during a process. And I think we can also all be accountable in terms of considering who is being excluded and who isn't at the table, who needs to be and how to get them there.
I think the SVRI work on ethical guidance is really helpful. And I think it can serve many of us to reflect and to be guided in what does it mean to be ethical when it comes to sexual violence research. So I would like to extend a warm thank you to the SVRI for this guideline.
So are our guests optimistic? Will ethical funding help in violence against women?
Yes, but qualified yes. Yes, I am optimistic. Now more than ever, there is a growing number of activists working to shift the power, to move away from more top-heavy and top-down systems of funding towards a flatter and more equitable paradigm of community-led development, community-led research. But these promising practices do keep me optimistic, although at the same time, I also recognize that there is much work needed to be done to ensure that activists like us advocating for ethical funding and equitable partnerships with civil society and feminist organizations in low and middle income countries are able to reach beyond our silos and niche movements and reach more of the donors, UN agencies, and international NGOs that too often have control over the resources needed to advance our agenda for ethical funding.
I am optimistic. We're seeing amazing results from some of the work that's being done. For instance, Southern-led women's rights organizations working at the grassroots, doing incredible work and actually having amazing impacts on the ground. I have no doubt that funding better and funding differently, funding more ethically leads to better work, leads to more inclusive work and better results for the communities that are most affected. And I think if we can build on this momentum between organizations so that the advocacy around these issues spreads wider and further, I definitely do feel optimistic about the future. Yes.
I'm optimistic in terms of this is the road we need to go. And I think with the SVRI and others in the SVRI forum, I could see good actors who really take this very serious. And when looking at the network, I get very inspired to see that researchers are doing this not only for research for its own sake, but having the focus on the people who are affected by violence and the fact that researchers want to make a contribution to the fight against violence. And I think that is very inspirational.
Thanks to our guests, Annika Leysen, Catherine Marie Berlin and Aisha Margo for joining us on the podcast. I'm Elizabeth Dartnell.
And I am Angelica Pino. You have been listening to the Sexual Violence Research Podcast by the SVRI. To find out more about our mission, visit svri.org.
To free the world of violence against women and violence against children, we need everyone to hear our message. So please subscribe, like and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this episode far and wide.
Thanks for listening, and we will see you for episode 5, which tackles the subject of mental health.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.